Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to The Vanished ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts.
As a parent, the thing that hurts more than anything is to have your child hurting and you can't fix it. And the older they get, the more that becomes true. So we're simply living the nightmare of every parent who's had a 16-year-old with a new license and a set of car keys. Every parent who's ever had their children late for a curfew and you happen to hear some sirens going off in the distance and you think, is that my child? You know, they're late. Where are they? Well, we're living that nightmare. Our child didn't come home. We get a call at 2 a.m. in the morning. We're both sound asleep. And you get a call from police officer 2 a.m. saying, we found your son's wrecked car and we don't know where he is. And it's been that way since then.
21-year-old Jason Landry disappeared on December 13th, 2020. Jason had just completed his first semester at Texas State University. He was making the nearly three-hour drive to his family's home in Missouri City, Texas, for the winter break. It's believed that Jason left around 10:55 p.m. that night. Around 12:30 a.m., a volunteer firefighter discovered Jason's car crashed on a dark road just outside of Luling, Texas, a town that was along Jason's route home. Jason's parents were jolted awake that night when the phone rang. On the other line was an officer from the Texas Highway Patrol, informing them that they had found their son's car crashed, but there was no sign of Jason at the scene. That was the beginning of this nightmare for the Landry family, and more than 10 months later, they're still searching for answers. I'm Marissa, and from Wondery, this is episode 312 of The Vanished, Jason Landry's story. Audible offers thousands of popular favorites, exclusive new series, guided wellness programs, comedy, and exciting new voices in audio. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. The Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere. While traveling, working out, walking, doing chores, you decide. I like to listen a little bit each evening while I'm cooking dinner. And it's great for my evening walks, too. Recently, I've been listening to Lay Them to Rest by Laura Norton. It's a fantastic audiobook. You don't want to miss it. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/MIA or text MIA to 500-500. That's audible.com/MIA or text MIA to 500-500. When Jason disappeared, he left behind a trail of bizarre clues that his family has been trying to piece together ever since. But before we get into all of those strange details, we're going to take a look back at Jason's life. We spoke to Jason's mom, Lisa, who told us about her son.
He's the third of three, so he's my baby. All of them are my babies, but he's the baby of my babies. He had this smile. He could get away with anything. I remember his preschool teachers telling me they would always give in to him. And I was like, no, you're training him, you know, not to behave for me. He did. He had this precious smile and grin that would just help him get away with anything. And he gave the best hugs. He'd come at you with these arms open straight out to the side and then wrap them around you and envelop you in his hug. He loved music and he played, he started in the band in middle school, and he had played piano before that. He played several instruments, trumpet, euphonium, baritone, bass, trombone. He was trying to teach himself how to play guitar recently. He was in the jazz band and the regular band, you know, marching and orchestra. He was someone who was always positive. It didn't matter how far behind he was on getting something done, but he was always like, don't worry, I'll get it, it's okay. But he had such a kind heart. He was just precious, always there to help. I guess I would call him an extrovert because he was happy to talk to anybody. He went to Camp Choye for many years. That's in a Christian camp in Livingston. He worked there for 2 summers. You go for 5 years, you get a cross necklace that signifies you've been there for the 5 years, and then they add little beads to it each year after that. And he wore that all the time. I was looking back at some photos, and he had it on in so many photos. And then when he started driving, he hung it from his rearview mirror. We were able to recover that, and we still have it. I have it hanging up in the house.
We also spoke to Jason's father, Kent, who told us more about Jason.
I guess every child, it's always interesting as your kids get older, how they have some attributes of you, some of your mom. Both his big brother and his big sister were very self-motivated, very directed, kind of type A. Jason was our musician and artist, a more free-spirited, just always happy one of the three. Not to say that his brother and sister aren't great and happy and all that, but he's the one who did things differently. He did not go through life with a plan, for sure.
While speaking with Jason's older brother, Kyle, he told us about growing up with Jason from a sibling's perspective.
He was born when I was about 18 months old. We lived in South Carolina at the time. He was born in Augusta, Georgia. And we were in Austin for a while. Then we moved to Mississippi. And me and my brother, because we were pretty close in age, we always had kind of sibling rivalry, I guess you could say. And I loved my brother. And we lived in the same room when we were younger. We were just roommates. And we played together a lot, being at that age. And he always had been more the rambunctious of the two of us, I guess you could say. But he was always very kind-hearted to everyone that he didn't know. He was a little bit shy, but he was always very adventurous. He liked doing like skateboarding and just liked being outside. He liked to play video games. He liked to play guitar. He was always musically gifted. He played trumpet.
Kent explained that after high school, Jason started college at Sam Houston University in Huntsville, Texas.
So he graduated from high school. He did okay. He actually started at Sam Houston. Wasn't his first choice, but his first year, he had a serious girlfriend. He spent too much time with her. And like many of us in our first year of college, it doesn't go to plan. So he enjoyed himself greatly with his first taste of freedom. And so he came home and worked real hard. He went to junior college here locally, worked real hard, got his grades up, and really kind of started spending some time kind of thinking what it is he wants to do. I think all of us kind of 18, you think you can take on the world, and then the world punches you in the nose, and you kind of, you take a step back and you go, okay, you know, we just told him, said, take the time to think about what it is that interests you. What do you want to do with the rest of your life? I mean, you know, what do you enjoy? And he's always loved music, and he started looking around, and Texas State, surprisingly to me at least, when he started looking, has one of the top 10 programs in the nation for sound recording technology. So with his love for music and enough kind of techno geek in him, gamer, all that kind of stuff, he said, you know, I think that's what I want to do. And I'm like, well, you got to get your grades up. You got to get into Texas State. And then once you're there, you can't apply into that program. You actually have to do a year of at least a year there at Texas State before you can apply. And you actually have to get into the music department. You have to have a music portfolio and piano and all this kind of stuff. And so he was working to get that in. This was his, before he disappeared, that was his first semester at Texas State.
Jason was following his dreams and was excited to begin his first semester at Texas State in the fall of 2020. Unfortunately, due to the worsening COVID-19 pandemic, things didn't go quite as Jason had hoped or planned. Kent told us more.
He got in, and then COVID hit. And I would say now in retrospect, and I really do think for a lot of younger adults, by that I mean who are in high school and college for COVID, as someone who's older, I think we don't realize how much impact that has had. Like, for example, Jason goes off to Texas State, finally has an idea of what he wants to do with the world, is really excited to get there. We move him in, and the whole campus shuts down. He actually never got to go to a class. He never got to go on campus, never got to meet anyone. You just sit in an apartment, and he actually got quarantined twice because other people around him got COVID. I think that really did impact him a lot. We're all different, but Jason is an extrovert like me. So just sitting in an apartment, one room apartment by yourself, because he had roommates, but they were both older. They were both seniors and they're both in frats. You know, they were in a different place. Yeah, it was real lonely for him. He had three of his professors, literally, they just had an online syllabus. They never even did lectures online. You know, most of all the kids, you know, and you met via Zoom, you had a lecture, there was some opportunity to interact, even though it's in front of a camera. Jason, for three of his classes, literally the professors handed him the syllabus and said, good luck. Your two tests are on there. There are no lectures, but you have your book. Good luck with that. Which for Jason is the worst kind of thing. And I would say for me too, I couldn't achieve like that. And Jason's a lot like me. Just we need more direction in our life. Yeah. See, Jason and I are the most extroverted. My wife's a CPA. She's the introvert. His brother and his sister are kind of a mix, but they're very self-directed and very, very organized, very diligent. So even though they didn't like it, they still push through. But Jason being non-directed and extroverted, it was just, that's the worst possible thing you could do to him. You just give him time on his hands and nothing to do. Frankly, one of the things he did is he smoked too much pot. I was talking with an attorney friend of mine, because I used to be a lawyer. I was talking to an attorney friend of mine that had kids also in college, and we were talking about it. And he was really very kind of strongly off-put that Jason had pot on him. I can't remember, son or daughter who's like a freshman or sophomore in college said, Dad, everybody right now is self-medicating. It's just a question of, are they doing it with pot or alcohol or whatever? Because we don't have any interaction. We all know what college should be. It should be the best time of our lives. We should be going to a football game. We should be going out to parties. We should be going out and doing stuff and meeting people, having the time of our lives. Instead, we're locked in our apartments. And everyone handles that differently. And I don't have a problem. I mean, I'm no saint. I'm no teetotaler. Even I am a pastor, but I'm not naive. I love to help people. That's what got me into practice of law and got me into ministry. So I don't have any issue with it. I don't feel like I was on the dark side and now I'm on the light side or anything like that. But I'm also not naive enough to know everybody handles situations differently.
Jason was struggling with the isolation while away at college in the midst of a global pandemic. So Jason decided to get a job while at school. It was one thing that he could do to get out of the apartment and be around people.
So he started working at Jimmy John's. He had done that after high school. He had worked at Jimmy John's here. When they opened back up in San Marcos, he started working there. And I kept telling him, no, you need to focus more on your classes and not worry about making money. But looking back, I think he needed it to get out of that apartment because there was nothing that they could do. And this gave him somewhere to go and some people to meet and something to do. So he did enjoy that.
As the fall semester was coming to a close, Jason was excited to return home for the holidays and visit with his family and friends back in Missouri City. Kent explained to us that they didn't have any plans set in stone, but he knew Jason and his brother Kyle would be returning home from college that week, the week that Jason disappeared.
Jason's at Texas State, his brother's at A&M, and his big sister already graduated from A&M, and she is living and working in Chicago. So this was the first, Jessica's only been married a little bit over a year now, so this was the first time we were separated as a family. They were both done with finals. Jason was done like the day before, 2 days before, something like that. But they were both actually hanging out with friends at school, waiting for Jessica to come home, their big sister. That week, effectively, was the week that they were coming home, because it was only the 13th. I think Jason was one of his buddies from high school. I think he went to college in another state and was going to come by through San Marcos. I think that's what Jason was waiting on or whatever. So we weren't sure what day he was coming. We told both the boys, hey, it's just mom and me. Jessica's not here. Come whenever you want. We weren't necessarily expecting them that night. We were just expecting them sometime that week.
The day before Jason went missing, he texted his mom his Christmas list. Lisa told us about that text from Jason.
The day before he went missing, he had texted me his Christmas list because he hadn't done that yet with finals and everything going on. And it was funny. It was so detailed. He had so many things on the list, and they were all very specific and most of them expensive. But he put on there that he wanted socks, and then later he'd bring it up again. And then later in the text, he said, if you're unsure what kind of socks exactly I want, one of my favorite pairs is the one I got from Aunt Donna from the White Elephant Sock Christmas thing we did. The monkey business ones with the monkey in a suit and tie holding the briefcase in one hand and a banana in the other. So wacky and cool socks like that, but not basic ones with something just like tacos or dogs on them or something. That was in the text that he texted me with his long list. He was just so specific.
On the evening that Jason disappeared, he made plans with some friends to play video games. Kent explained how this transpired.
He had actually talked to a bunch of his buddies, and they do like most of the kids do now. All their friends from high school, they're all at different places, different schools. But they were all planning on getting on playing Call of Duty or whatever they were going to play late at night. So Jason was going to stay at the apartment. Then I think his roommates were going to be leaving or whatever. And he just decided to go ahead and leave and come home to meet everybody online and play games together. Yeah, he had told his buddy he had planned on leaving around closer to like 8:30, but didn't leave obviously till more like whatever it was, would have been, you know, 11, which for Jason, that's not absolutely surprising. I've learned the hard way with having college age kids starting to do something when I'm getting in bed. That's about par for the course. There's been many a time where my wife and I, we've been getting in bed at 10, 10:30, 11 o'clock, and they're going out with their friends. I mean, if he had called me and said, hey, Dad, I'm about to leave, I'd be like, do you really want to drive in the middle of the night? Because he'd only made this drive twice.
We all know there are things in life that you have to compromise on, but when it comes to your health, there's no compromise. So don't settle for that one doctor that isn't really addressing your needs. Instead, check out ZocDoc, the place where you can find and book doctors who will make you feel comfortable. And you can even search by location, availability, and insurance. ZocDoc is a free app and website where you can search and compare highly rated in-network doctors near you and instantly book appointments with them online. Once you find the doc you want, you can book them immediately. You can filter specifically for ones who take your insurance, are located near you, and treat basically any condition you're searching for. The typical wait time to see a doctor booked on ZocDoc is between just 24 and 72 hours. That's it. I use this, and you should too. Go to ZocDoc.com/vanished and download the ZocDoc app for free. Then find and book a top-rated doctor today. That's ZocDoc.com/vanished. ZocDoc.com/vanished. This message is sponsored by Greenlight. When you're a parent, you'll have your fair share of big talks with your kids. One of those big talks should involve money, and Greenlight can help with that. Greenlight is a debit card and money app for families. You can send your kids instant money transfers, get real-time notifications of spending, manage chores, and automate allowance. I've been using Greenlight with my older two kids for years. One thing that I love about it is that I can set up recurring or one-time chores, customized to my family's needs, and then my kids earn an allowance to reward them for a job well done. Not only does it motivate them to actually get the chores done, but it also teaches them a bit about financial literacy and independence. They're learning to earn, save, and spend wisely. So stop putting off the money talk and start putting your kids on the right path. Sign up for Greenlight today and get your first month free at greenlight.com/vanished. That's greenlight.com/vanished to try Greenlight for free. One more time, that's greenlight.com/vanished. Investigators believe that Jason left his apartment to drive home at around 10:55 p.m. on December 13th, 2020. They have detailed information from Jason's phone from that night about his location because he was using the Waze app for directions home. At 11:05 p.m., Jason drove onto Highway 80. He continued south, entering Caldwell County at 11:07 p.m. From there, he continued through several towns along Highway 80, and then entered the town of Luling at 11:24 p.m. Kent told us what they know about what happened after Jason got to Luling.
Waze turned on in his apartment parking lot at right before 11, I think. And, you know, he's tinging along like every 10 seconds. You can just see the little dots going right along into Luling. And this is the section, the only really worrisome section, because coming out of San Marcos, and you come into just a couple of little small towns. And what actually happens is you come into Luling on one highway and you have to make a right-hand turn, go a couple of blocks and take a left-hand turn, kind of going through Luling to go out to I-10. It's not a direct route. And what happened was Jason came into Luling and it was right at about 11:30 because he was using Waze. And our home address is on his phone. So he was on Waze, and Waze clicks like every 10 seconds or something like that. And you can follow him just coming from his apartment through San Marcos out into Luling, where he's sitting at the light, and that's where you're supposed to make the right turn. And about a block before that turn, he got a Snapchat. And so that turns Waze off and Snapchat on. But Snapchat only pings like much less consistently. And from that point onward at about 11:30, we don't know what happened. There's not lights and it's very poorly signed. It doesn't make it clear at all. And there is a sign that, one of those little signs that say I-10 this way, but it's on the far side of the intersection at the back end of the intersection. I didn't see it at first. Someone had to say, hey, it's right there. Look. And there's actually on the Find Jason Landry Facebook page, there's actually a picture of the intersection just so people understand. Because a lot of people, particularly people who aren't from Texas or haven't driven a lot of little Texas towns, they seem to think that it would be unusual to miss this turn. And so we don't know what happened. I think it could be any combination of he dropped his phone. Because his phone was never, Waze was never turned back on, or Snapchat was never turned back on. And so anyway, his car ends up about 2 miles outside of Luling. If you're sitting at that intersection and you went through the light, you actually kind of go through a back part of Luling, and you end up on this road called Salt Flat Road that actually turns into a dirt road.
Jason missed the turn he needed to make in Luling to get to I-10. His family isn't sure if he missed it due to poor signage or what, but this is where Jason's digital footprint ends. They believe that Jason continued straight before turning onto Spruce Street, which later becomes Salt Flat Road. More than an hour after Jason had entered the town of Luling at 11:24 p.m., his car was found crashed on Salt Flat Road.
He ends up on Salt Flat Road, assuming it was him driving, whoever was driving. You can tell, based on the skid marks, it kind of went off on the shoulder, overcorrected, and the car probably spun out. And that's what ended up making him come rest kind of driver's side against some barbed wire in a ditch.
When Jason's car was found, it was inoperable. But law enforcement officials believe that the crash was survivable and that Jason would have been able to walk away from the crash scene with little to no injuries. Jason's parents received a phone call in the middle of the night to tell them that Jason had been in an accident. Lisa told us what was going through her mind when she was awoken in the early morning hours of December 14th.
We got a phone call somewhere around 1:30 in the morning. And since my husband's a pastor, I was assuming something was wrong with a church member. Never considered it was for us. He told us that he was in Caldwell County. I actually was thinking about the city Caldwell, which is near College Station. So my first thought actually went to Kyle, who was at A&M. But then he explained they were in Luling and it was Caldwell County, and that they found Jason's car, but they couldn't find him. And I still was very positive about the whole thing. Couldn't imagine really anything being that bad. So I was just taking it all in and was like, well, it was that super cold night. It just started that day getting cold, and it had gotten so cold, and the wind gusts were so bad that the trooper on the phone told me that it was like Arctic wind there. And I was just like, well, you got to find him if he's just wandering around without his car. So it was just horrible to imagine him being out there in the cold.
Unable to just sit at home and wait for another phone call, Kent jumped into action.
We get a call at about 2 a.m. from the Texas Highway Patrol and telling us that they found Jason's car, found his backpack, and it had his wallet in it. And has he called you or whatever? So we have the family locator thing. Get on, look on our phone, and we can see the pinging of where it is. And I said, well, he's on this road. He says, oh, the tow truck just took the car away. So it's in the car. And then we can look and see that it's literally his phone is sitting in the tow lot, in the impound lot. So the highway patrolman just talks, not very helpful, and tell my wife, okay, you stay here in case he got a ride or someone calls or whatever, but I'm going to find him. I'm going to look. So I hop in the car and drive there, and I get there, and it's about, well, by that time, it's, 4:35 in the morning. I was the only person out there because the highway patrolman had gone home and gone to sleep and didn't tell anyone else to continue the search. So I'm the one who found his watch, his shirt, his socks, his slides, his shorts, his t-shirt. I knew they were his. I was driving down the road looking for him. I thought any minute I'd see him walking down the road, and I see clothes lying in the middle of the dirt road. I'm like, what the hell are those? And I look and I'm like, those are Jason's because he wears crazy socks. And I knew those socks. They were SpongeBob socks. And I'm like, I know those socks. I know that t-shirt. It's from Camp Choye, the Christian camp where the boys worked and went over in Livingston. And like, this is Jason's stuff. So I took it, put it in the back of the car, kept looking for him. And the tow lot didn't open up till, I think, 7 in the morning. And that's when they let me go in and get his phone. So I had his phone since that very morning. They gave it to local law enforcement, and they did some looking in it, and we've had it examined by multiple forensic people by now. I turned it over to them, along with his laptop and everything else.
Along with Jason's clothes that were found in the road, Jason's betta fish was found dead in a tumbler near his backpack. While there was no blood found in Jason's car, they later found blood on the band of his underwear, and small traces of blood were on the inner side tag of his shorts. Kent thought that when he arrived that chilly morning, that he would find other people searching for his son. To his shock and dismay, he was the only person looking for Jason. When the tow yard opened at 7 a.m., Kent made his way there, where he found Jason's phone and jacket still inside the car. Away at college himself at Texas A&M in College Station, Kyle awoke on the morning of the 14th to a flurry of messages and missed calls.
I found out he was missing when I woke up on December 14th. I started cooking breakfast, and I hadn't checked my phone in a while. And as I was sitting down to eat breakfast, I saw a couple calls from my mom. I saw a text from my mom that said, hey, Jason is missing. It looks like he was driving maybe home to Houston, and his car was in an accident, and he was missing. And so at the time, I decided that I needed to go. So at the time, I had just finished my laundry the night before. I hadn't folded any of it, so I grabbed my hamper and just threw it in the car because I didn't know what was going on there, and I decided to drive to Houston to be with my mom. And then while I was driving, I was just sitting there thinking, like, any second now I'm going to get a call and say they found him. And then as I got about 30 minutes away from my place in College Station, I decided, no, I'm going to go to Luling.
Lisa and other family members joined Kent in Luling to help with the search efforts. Lisa was certain that they would find Jason quickly, and there would be a simple explanation for all of this.
My husband ended up driving there to be there when they find him, and our family started joining us, and Texar came and did so much for a week there to help, you know, to try to find him. And it's hard to sit back and let everybody else do the work, but they've been trained, they know what they're doing, and we don't want to get in the way and screw something up, so we would just wait and wait. But everybody was so great about keeping us updated and helping us out. And I kept thinking, we're going to know something soon, we're going to find him. You know, he's probably back in his apartment sleeping and no one can hear it. You know, he can't hear the door because he's on the third floor or something. And so we had, you know, the police go there and see if he was in his apartment. And kept expecting to find him at any time. And eventually, I don't know, around 7 in the morning, decided to start calling some family so I could pray so we could find him. And I still never expected to go much further than that. It's unbelievable. It's been over 9 months.
Kyle described to us what the scene looked like when he arrived in Luling.
It's a small town. It's got a Buc-ee's. It's more of an oil field town, I think. It's a pretty small town with a lot of like ranching and stuff around. And so it was like a mile or two outside of Luling. There were a couple houses along the road, but it's not a very populated area. It was down a gravel road. So I was driving and I'm like, where the heck am I? Kind of thing. And I pull in and I just saw a bunch of my cousins, my father, just standing around with some police officers at the time. And they're kind of looking around. And so I pulled up just as the Texar people were getting there, and I remember getting the explanation from my dad at the same time as he was getting it, giving it to the Texar person for the most part. I talked to one of my cousins after, who was there before me, just kind of got his take on it, and it was a very surreal experience once I got there, because when I was driving there, it was just like, I kept thinking, I'm going to get a call any minute, and he's going to be found, and then I'm going to get there. And we're just going to, it's going to be all right. And then I got there. I was just like, well, maybe he walked somewhere. And I knew they'd been kind of looking for him for a while. So I didn't even know what to do at the time. Because, I mean, anything I would have done had already been thought of just like driving up and down the street, just kind of looking around the area. And really, it just turned into a waiting game at that point. It was a very weird experience of, what do you mean he's missing? And there's been an accident. And I just kept thinking that any minute now, I'll just get a call and just say he found him. And he just kind of wandered off a little bit looking for help. Because that's the kind of person he is. I wouldn't expect him to stay around the car. In my mind, he would go walking around. Even though I think in survival, you're supposed to stay around the accident or whatever. I saw it in my mind that he probably would have gone and wandered off all the way back to Luling, which is like 3 or 4 miles. I wouldn't be surprised if he tried walking there.
In the early days of the investigation, search dogs led them to a nearby pond. Kyle told us more about the search of the pond.
After like the first day, they kind of changed it to looking for other things than just him alive, obviously. And they kind of found a place that they had a place of interest. It was like a pond over there, and they did a lot of work in that area, and they seemed pretty confident at the time that that's kind of what had happened, where he'd like hit his head and fallen in, and I don't know, maybe drowned, but they never found anything there. And I remember the whole time we were there, we were very distraught, and I don't think we had a lot of hope after the first day. And so every hour was spent like staring at like this hill, and we were waiting on a truck to come over and say they found something. And I just sat there staring at that hill, waiting for them to come over it and say something. And then for so many days, they'd come over and they'd say, we still haven't found anything, but we're still looking. And then on the Friday, when they had completely drained the pond, they still hadn't found anything. And they didn't know what to do at that point.
After days of searching the area and draining the pond, Jason's family began to wonder if he wasn't there after all. They held out hope that maybe something else had happened, and Jason was okay. But as the days wore on and the holidays crept closer and closer, their hope began to dwindle.
And we decided to go home at that point. We decided, I think across the family, it was almost a sense of hope came over us because no body had been found at the time. So we just assumed he'd show up. That never happened. And I think that the first time my dad really came to terms with it was when he didn't show up to Christmas, because he kept feeling like he was just scared that we'd be mad that he wrecked his car, and we'd been so worried, and then we didn't show up for Christmas. It got a lot more real.
Kent told us earlier that Jason was known to smoke marijuana. We asked if there was any evidence that Jason was driving under the influence of alcohol or any other substance that night.
It's possible. You know, I can tell you this. The marijuana cigarettes they found were in a pill box container, zipped up in his backpack. There are no butts. There are no anything in his car. It was searched. It was in his zipped up in his backpack, unsmoked in the backseat of his car, not accessible to him. There were no butts, no joints, no anything, no open containers or anything like that in the front seat. Now, there was supposedly the guy who found it said he smelled marijuana in the car. I don't know. I never smelled it. I know what marijuana smells like. And they searched the car. They searched all around looking for joints because, frankly, the highway patrolman, that was actually what he thought. He thought he had a drunk college kid driving around DUI. That's what he was most worried about. He wasn't worried about a missing person. That's why he went home and went to bed. He thought he had a DUI case to make, which ticks me off as a dad and as a lawyer. But generally, I mean, because having been a lawyer and worked many, many death cases involving DUI, because that's what I did. For a plaintiff and defense attorney, I did auto accident cases. I have just always been, they would say, very, very annoying about drinking and driving, because in this day of Uber and everything else, it's just the height of stupidity to be drinking and driving. You know, every one of my kids has an Uber account, and I'm like, look, there's never going to be a time that I will question you spending money on Uber if you've been drinking and you need to get home. I said that'll be the easiest $30 I ever spend. And so, is it possible? Sure, anything's possible at this point. I think it's much more likely that Jason had smoked it at home. Now, was he under the influence at that point after smoking not in his car an hour later? It might be possible. I would probably say probably could have certainly been a contributing cause to the accident if he was somehow impaired, but I don't think he was actively smoking while driving.
Since Jason disappeared, there have been many stories about what may have happened. Kent isn't sure what to make of them all.
Yeah, we've had the $10,000 reward. We have private investigators working. There are many different leads and many different stories. I've heard that that's not the best part of town. That's where you would drive to go get drugs or whatever. There are rumors that Jason was robbed at that light and fought back, and they shot him and killed him, and they disposed of his body. There's rumors that somehow they got him to go somewhere else where they attempted to rob him, and they shot him and killed him. Some say it was a carjacking gone bad or whatever, which Jason drove a 2003 or 4, I forget, Nissan Altima. So it's not exactly, if I were carjacking someone, I don't think I'd want, I could think of a lot nicer cars. So we don't know. It could have been any number of things, but it could be if he just missed the turn and kept going. If he had lost his phone, like dropped it, he could have been driving. And I've got to say, I've done the same thing, driving with one hand and fishing with the other.
While there have been stories or rumors suggesting that something sinister occurred the night that Jason disappeared, Ken also believes that it's possible that Jason may have become disoriented after the accident.
He was probably at least concussed, maybe more, I don't know, disoriented, and probably started walking back to town. The back window was broken out by some tree branches. It was below freezing, certainly with about a 20-mile-an-hour wind. So the wind chill was really bad. It's like those one of those 2 days down in central Texas that you actually could freeze to death. And that's one of the things is, you know, here we are over 8 months out. You just kind of sometimes you take a step back and you go like, this was the only day that it could have been deadly, probably until February.
Kent found a bunch of Jason's belongings scattered along the roadway. They know what Jason was wearing at the time because there are photos of him from that night. They believe the clothes that were found were the ones that he was wearing. And we know that it was cold that night. Sometimes when people experience hypothermia, they do things that appear strange to us. One of those things is paradoxical undressing. Kent wonders if that could explain why Jason's clothes were found left behind on the road.
That's part of the kind of the hypothermic reaction, one of the ways. So if he were in his car and were, say, knocked unconscious and gets out of his car and is disoriented and injured and then starts moving around, because he could have been unconscious for 30 minutes for all we know, and starts moving around, what your body does, as I understand it, is all your blood goes to your core to keep you alive. And then you start moving around, so your blood all rushes to your extremities and it feels like you're overheating. You have, it's called paradoxical undressing. He was wearing shorts, socks, flip-flops, or slides, slide sandals, shorts and a t-shirt, just athletic shorts and a t-shirt, a heated car. I mean, he's literally just driving a couple hours home, so he just throws on his sandals when he decides to leave. And he probably takes all his clothes off, this paradoxical undressing, because I'm the one who found him. And we don't know what happens. If we're doing Occam's razor, keep it simple. He missed a poorly lit turn that he had only been to at daylight and was probably driving along, missed his phone. I found his phone, and it's in that annoying place between your driver's seat and the center arm console. I actually had to go back from the back, you know, open the back door, go behind the front seat and reach it. It had slid down onto like the rail. And if I had dropped my phone and it had slid there, instead of doing the smart thing, pulling over and getting it, I've done it too many times, unfortunately, driven with one hand and fished with the other hand, going down this road, the middle of nowhere, mostly focused on trying to find that phone, and probably went over a little bit too much, overcorrected. Probably was knocked unconscious and had at least a concussion and was absolutely disoriented from that point forward. And if he took off his clothes because of paradoxical undressing, having been out there in the middle of the night, there is nothing out there. Nothing out there. There's probably not four homes within a 5 mile radius. It's just oil field and ranch land. But Jason would be looking for help, looking for someone. Thinking that if, well, maybe someone's on the other side of this hill, and probably laid down in the cold weather and woke up in heaven. Keeping it simple, that's probably the simplest explanation. There's a lot of wild animals there. I mean, when I drove there that very night, and I probably didn't go 2 miles from, and I drove the exact same route to up this road, Salt Flat Road. I think I had to stop for three different sets of deer running by and a coyote. So they have a lot of animal activity. They have a lot of feral hogs.
There have been other theories about what happened to Jason that his family feels are outlandish. Theories that he staged this accident to take off and start a new life or join a cult. Nothing in Jason's life pointed to any of those things.
I know this. Jason's not the type to run away. You know, some people say, oh, well, you know, young man, blah, 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 blah. You know, he probably ran away, joined a cult, all this kind of stuff. No, that's not Jason. It's possible for some people, but Jason doesn't plan anything. And if you're running away, you don't leave your wallet and your cell phone I know exactly what he was doing because his friends said what he was doing, and his backpack was filled with his PlayStation and his gaming equipment. And he was just coming back home, see some friends, do play some games.
Lisa struggles with all of the unknowns and doesn't know what to think about all of the theories floating around.
It's just so hard to tell. Sometimes I think he wandered and was in the area and just curled up somewhere because it was cold and was never found. But then sometimes I think he was removed from the location, whether by someone that was trying to be helpful or someone that wasn't. I just don't know. It's likely there was foul play, but I just don't know. Just because it's so weird. There's nothing. It just seems like if he was there, there'd be something by now. If he was fine, he would be home. So something's not right. I do know that God's been giving me messages that he's in heaven, though. So I don't feel like he's out there in a bad situation.
Lisa also wonders how Jason ended up on that dark road that night. He had driven that route a couple of times, but not enough to be familiar with it. Was he just lost and turned around? Or did something else happen to Jason?
He came home two other times, and maybe not even that direction both times. Once to vote and once for Thanksgiving. So he was not totally familiar with the area, and he always relied on his phone, Waze, or whatever. And so I imagine that it would have been easy for him to get to that light in Luling where you need to turn right to go to the freeway and then left again. I imagine it would have been easy for him to go straight through it, especially if it was green, but shoot, even if it's red, if you're just not thinking and you're just driving, I don't know. But so it appears that he went straight through that light and kept going, but then the road turned to gravel and small, a back rural road, and it's really dark. So I can't imagine why he went so far on that road. I keep thinking that maybe he just couldn't find somewhere good to turn around because it was dark and the roads were narrow and it's just hard to do that. But I don't know. I don't know. Was someone chasing him? You know, someone road rage? Or I just don't know. But he went several miles up that gravel road, and then they found his car facing the opposite direction, slammed against a tree and barbed wire fence, and then found his backpack and his wallet and his phone. I mean, that's, I guess, the reason I wonder about him being taken is because who would leave their phone? I mean, we all have our phones no matter what we're doing. It's the first thing you look for. So why it would be in his car and he wouldn't have grabbed that first? Then he left his wallet, his backpack, his PlayStation. I mean, he was bringing that home to play games with his friends, and that's worth a lot of money and is worth a lot to him. So it makes no sense that any of that was just left there. The trooper told me that night that he said that when people are missing from the scene, it's like they're trying to hide something. So that's what he thought right off the bat, that he just was trying to hide something. But we don't know that. There's just too many unknowns.
The digital footprints that Jason left behind also leave Lisa questioning what everything means or adds up to.
We do know that Waze had gone to the background on his phone about two blocks before that. So it wasn't active on his phone when he got to that intersection. Two blocks before he opened Snapchat, it was still on. It was just not active. It was in the background. And it never became active again after that. So he never pulled it back up to see where he was. And why the heck not? You know, why not? What's the story there? So you kind of wonder, was it road rage? Did he stumble into something that was going on in the middle of the night? Because he wouldn't have kept driving without knowing where he was going because he doesn't know where he's going. He uses the app. It was not like our neighborhood, you know, it was fairly new to him, not familiar.
Kent told us that there have been many searches for Jason that have been unsuccessful, and also about some of the complicating factors of searching that particular geographic area.
So if there was a body, now, 8 months plus, there's just bones scattered and half buried. And we've had 6 major searches. We've had drones, helicopters, planes, cadaver dogs. We've drained multiple lakes and bodies of waters and creeks around the thing because the cadaver dogs have been hitting on the water. Well, this is in the middle of an oil production and gas production field. And there's actually, when they train the dogs, they don't train them with rotting human flesh. They train them with a chemical that is the artificial representation of that. We've had FBI dogs, and we've had FBI, prison, private, all the different law enforcement agencies. We've had dogs from all over the state work it. And they've hit on multiple things, but it appears that there is, when water and one of these hydrocarbon chemicals come in contact with each other, they make that smell. That, to a dog, smells like a rotting corpse. So they've hit on the bodies of water. We've literally drained multiple bodies of water more than once. Dog hit on it and said, there's a body in there. They drained the whole thing, searched the whole thing. There's nothing. Fill it back up, start working the area again, and the dog goes back to the body of water and says, there's a body in there. You know, sometimes they found rotting deer carcasses and whatnot, but, you know, it's the particulars of this area, I think, have made the cadaver dogs in particular, made it very hard for them to get any trustworthy trail, in the sense of, with that scent interference, and because of the all of the petrochemical smell in the air, sounds like a chemical refinery out there, the dogs can literally only work for about 10 minutes before they become nose blind. So it's the dog aspect of it has been particularly difficult, as I understand it, which is all you got, basically, unless you happen to walk upon it. And people, I guess, who only live in big cities or suburban areas, I invite them to go out into the country and try to find some bones. They have done, I think it's between 4,000 and 6,000 digital images. We've got some professors, because the Texas Body Farm is actually at Texas State, and the professors, a lot of the professors that are specialists in there, teach at Texas State in that area. So we actually have that tie, and they're actually working on it right now as we speak. And they've overlaid all of these thousands of digital imagery over the whole area. And then Texas Search and Rescue has the 6 major searches and where everyone has gone. And they put all that together into a computer model. And that model took over a month of computer time to process. And out of that, they come out with these, I think it's like boxes of 10 by 10, 10 feet by 10 feet. That they have to go, and there's over, I don't know how many, I think there are 40,000 images, because there's about 4,000 of them that have something that might be bones or something, that then they have to look at and see if it could be something worth going actually looking at in person. They get a certain number of these, and then they have that, hand that over to Texas Search and Rescue. Texas Search and Rescue goes out and checks those areas, and they're doing that as we speak. You know, a lot of people are kind of in the background going, well, what's going on? Why isn't anything happening? Well, something's happening, but it's an incredibly slow and laborious process, because from a drone a couple of hundred feet in the air, a cow carcass and some bones from a cow or a deer or a pig or coyote or whatever, number one, right now, everything is overgrown. I was out there a couple of weeks ago. I go out there occasionally and just walk around and look. And I realized I've been out there in all weathers, and I'm literally walking by going, I could be 2 feet away from something and I would never see it, because everything is so green and overgrown. And of course, one of the things is, if you're freezing to death, you have a tendency to burrow down, or, you know, animals hide bones, or, you know, they're spread probably over a half acre. I can't believe it's been almost 9 months. It's just stunning to think it's been that long, only a few hours away between, you know, between San Antonio, Austin, Houston, just kind of smack dab between all three of them. Someone disappears and we can't find them. Feels like they're on the far side of the moon. There are thousands, literally tens of thousands of missing people. And we think we know everything. Everything in the world is discovered. If someone goes missing, you know, it's only, hopefully it's a matter of time, but it's a lot harder than you think it is.
Investigators have pushed to get a geofence warrant to see what other phones were in the area when Jason disappeared. This is a newer technology, and Kent explained how they work and how it could possibly help in Jason's case.
Well, for your listeners, it's based on your cell phone. And you draw a box around an area and you say what cell phones are in this box at a given point in time. It's cutting edge technology, but you get a dump from a cell phone tower. And normally it's very, very limited because, of course, if they were to do a cell phone tower dump within a mile radius of where I sit right now, oh, well, they'd hit 50,000 people. So it would be an invasion of privacy, but out there, if you did a window from 11:30 to 12:30, just who was in that area, a mile radius of the accident scene, you may not get anyone other than Jason and the young man who found the car. But if there's anyone else, they're a suspect. Because another one of the stories that's floating around there is Jason was walking back down this gravel road looking for help. And someone hit him who was DUI. And he disposed of the body, hit him and killed him because he was DUI and he didn't want to get caught, didn't want to lose his job.
The Vanished is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up after the winter, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. It's a good time to think about the right amount of socializing for you. Maybe you thrive around people, or maybe you prefer more alone time. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. A therapist can help you learn how to set boundaries so you feel empowered to be the best version of yourself. Everyone can benefit from therapy. It's not just for those who've experienced major trauma. So if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, so it's designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/vanished today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/vanished.
Everyone knows that finding the perfect t-shirt can be a challenge. I've always had problems whether it was with the fit or quality. Luckily, the perfect t-shirt does exist, and you can find it at Skims. From cropped silhouettes to long-sleeve layering tees, there's a style for everyone. You know that I've been wearing Skims for a long time, and recently tried one of their t-shirts. It's the best-fitting tee I've ever worn. Skims makes the best basics and foundations. I got the boyfriend t-shirt in Onyx, and it's so soft and comfortable. I want to wear it every day. It literally fits like a dream. Shop the Skims t-shirt shop at skims.com, now available in sizes extra, extra small to 4X. If you haven't yet, be sure to let them know I sent you. After you place your order, select podcast in the survey, and select my show in the drop-down menu that follows. We had the opportunity to speak with Captain Jeff Ferry from the Caldwell County Sheriff's Office in order to get a law enforcement perspective on Jason's case. He explained how the Caldwell County Sheriff's Office became involved in the search for Jason.
So the Texas Highway Patrol responded to a single vehicle collision on Salt Flat Road. The caller that called that in was a volunteer firefighter. And he had indicated that the vehicle was unoccupied. We had some pretty adverse weather that day. There was pretty significant weather coming in. It was kind of colder than typical, especially for Texas. It was very windy. And so when the caller said that the vehicle was unoccupied and that he had located what looked like blood, our deputies responded to go search the area for that missing person or the occupant of that vehicle. But our deputies never made it to the actual collision scene. They just checked the area. when Highway Patrol worked the collision, which is typical for us, in Caldwell County, accidents are investigated by the Highway Patrol. So while our deputies may do some collision reports, generally, if there's property damage, that is handled by Highway Patrol. And so in this incident, Highway Patrol went out there, worked the accident, and they discovered some property that belonged to Jason Landry, but they never discovered Jason Landry. So our office was asked to kind of search the area. We searched some abandoned properties. And then the next day, we were asked by Highway Patrol to assist with a search for him. They were asking for canine assets and some aerial assets, which we offered. But I think they ended up using some other assets the first day. That's how we were made aware of it.
We've seen photos of Jason's car after it had been towed away from the scene. And the car did have quite a bit of damage to it. However, we never saw photos of the car at the accident scene itself. So it's difficult to imagine exactly what happened that night. Captain Ferry described the accident scene for us and how he thinks the accident occurred.
My impression, so the single vehicle collision, and this much I'm extremely confident in, the vehicle was not in contact with any other vehicles. It was a single vehicle collision. When the vehicle kind of fishtailed, looks like it probably was traveling at a higher rate of speed than it should have been for the conditions. It looks like the driver's side wheel kind of went off the road. The driver overcorrected, and that sent that vehicle into a yaw. And the rear of the vehicle started sliding around. And so as that vehicle kind of fishtailed, it left the roadway, and the rear driver's side trunk panel impacted a tree that was at the fence line. That impact ceased the vehicle's movement forward, and that slung the front half of the car into the fence line, with that tree at the trunk being kind of the pivot point. And so when the front half of the vehicle, again, driver's side, came into contact with the fence line and some trees over there, that driver's side door would have been kind of in the fence line. And the blood that we mentioned, my impression is that most likely when Jason was exiting the driver's side of the vehicle, I can imagine him pushing the door open with his left hand, the driver's side door open with his left hand, and stepping out of the vehicle kind of with his left hip first, because he's kind of wedged in there. As he's stepping out of that vehicle with his left hip, right, as he's coming out, there was some mesquite thorns and obviously the barbed wire there. And my impression is that something likely went through his shorts and got popped him in the mud. There was a drop of blood located on the underwear and a drop of blood on the pair of shorts that we believe Jason was wearing. And again, the location of the blood on the shorts is consistent with an injury on the left rear kind of hind buttocks area. So that's the extent of the blood. Now, when the volunteer firefighter called it in, he said blood, but that's what he saw. That little drop, that's what he saw. DPS never saw that because DPS never went over to the close. So DPS, when they said the vehicle had blood, they were going off the statement by the fire department, but they had never verified that. That was just the trooper's interpretation. We have not tested that yet. We have not had a reason to test that. But it has been collected, and it's presumptive positive for human blood, but has not been tested as Jason's. And the crash did look completely survivable. There was no airbag deployment. You certainly could have suffered some type of head injury or something, but with that impact being towards the rear in the vehicle, there weren't side curtain airbags or anything. So it certainly we didn't get the impression from the inside of the vehicle that there had been any type of traumatic injury.
We were interested to hear what investigators believe happened to Jason. With so many theories swirling around this case, is there any evidence of foul play? Or is this a case of a tragic accident? Captain Ferry told us what he thinks.
While it's not against the law to be missing, and we don't believe a crime occurred, there is always the possibility that a crime did occur. So we have to be restrictive in the information we release so we don't compromise any kind of criminal investigation. Now, that being said, in all of the data we've poured through and surveyed, there is nothing to indicate that this is intentional, and there's nothing to indicate this is voluntary. I don't believe Mr. Landry just walked away with the intent of not returning. I don't think he walked away from his life because he was ashamed of anything or, you know, we looked at that, but there was nothing that supported that. I don't think this fits the classic voluntary or involuntary, because I don't think anybody took him or has information about him, but I don't think that he intentionally walked away from his life either. I don't think that was his intent.
Did Jason Landry walk away from his car on that chilly night, possibly disoriented, and got lost? If so, why hasn't he been found? Captain Ferry told us more about the terrain.
That salt flat area, that's right there along Plum Creek. Plum Creek in our part of the world is prone to flooding. We have very significant weather events related to rain in that part of the world, specifically around that salt flat. That is rural. There's not a lot of homes out there, specifically because it floods. That is all floodplain. And so there is, that's a lot of wells. There's a lot of ranchers that have cattle and things like that. So there's not a lot of homes. There's a lot of area. The terrain it's not necessarily difficult. There is some thick brush. There's a lot of mesquite. And then when you get around, obviously, sources of water, we do have some terrain features there, just, you know, some creeks and things that kind of break up the terrain. A lot of tributaries that feed into it. There's a couple of sloughs that just hold water that are used by ranchers throughout the year. The terrain itself is, I don't want to say it's unremarkable, but it's certainly nothing that's overly intimidating. I've been to other places where you're like, holy cow, I don't want to get lost out here. That's not this place. It just looks like Central Texas. It does not have, you know, some of the hills and features that other parts of Central Texas has. It is heavy vegetation down there in certain parts, and other parts are very cleared out because it is for grazing of cattle. So it's very desolate. There are no streetlights there. I mean, on that particular night, there was a meteorological event. We did have one of the meteor showers on that night. I don't believe you would have seen it, though, with the cloud coverage, with the weather coming in. So with a lot of clouds, no stars, no moon, no other light, I think anybody would be challenged in navigating through that terrain. Yeah, that's very easy to believe to have occurred.
Earlier, Kent spoke about the possibility of hypothermia due to the unusually cold weather that night. Captain Ferry agrees that this is a possibility in Jason's case.
I think hypothermia is certainly an option. I'm familiar with the concept of the paradoxical undressing and then terminal burrowing. Those are all scenarios that may have played out. I know with the wind chill that night and water sources in the area, it seems possible. Any individual who got wet and was unclothed and was out in the elements, I think it's reasonable to assume that individual would, without aid, would pretty quickly succumb to those elements. I think given those circumstances that we know, those elements on that night, I think it's possible. Now, can that occur without an unclothed body being wet? That I don't know. But with the presence of water in that area, I just think that amplifies the likelihood that a hypothermic event occurred.
Captain Ferry explained to us that the search for Jason has been a collaborative effort between various agencies and experts. Kent touched on some of this briefly earlier. Captain Ferry believes that some of the newer technologies they've been using could possibly help in other missing persons cases too.
Texar has spent thousands of hours both on the ground, literally beating their feet into the earth. We've had different canine teams out there from Texar to Texas Parks and Wildlife canines. We've had Texas Task Force search and rescue guys come out with their teams, canine teams. We've utilized fixed wing assets, helicopter assets, UAVs. A ton of drone data has been collected, drone images. And we were very fortunate we got to work, and I'm not sure that this has been done in any other missing person case to date, but we were very fortunate in that Texas State University has a criminologist over there, a doctor, Professor Kim Rosmo. He's a university chair in criminology, and he's in charge of that Center for Geospatial Intelligence and Investigation. And Dr. Rosmo was willing to sit down and look at all of both the investigation as a whole and see if, as a prior law enforcement investigator, he can look at it and go, hey, did you think about this? Or, maybe this is lacking, or let's try to get this. But Dr. Rosmo agreed to sit down and look at all of the GPS data from the search teams. And Dr. Rossmo used his Reverend Bay's missing person search optimization formula, and he created a heat map for us that said, based on the ability of your search team, here's the areas where they have been. You are more likely to be found in this area than this area. Again, based on terrain, features, and previous searches. And so they compiled all that data and generated a heat map. We then took all of the UAV images and ran that through a special software that identifies color anomalies. And so it works great. And, you know, if we're looking at a vast part of the world and we're looking for, you know, a guy in a red shirt, I tell the software, hey, find anything with a red pixelation in it. And the software identifies all these anomalies. Then we go back and go, oh, that's just a Dixie cup, or that's just a handkerchief. Oh, look, that's a T-shirt. That's something we need to go look at. In this instance, we believe Jason was naked. You know, that was a challenge for the software guys when they were trying to figure out what color do we tell the program to look for. Ultimately, we settled on, hey, let's look for bone. We took the UAV software images and ran them and identified several thousand images that are similar to bone. And we overlaid that with Dr. Rossmo's heat map. And when we overlaid those two things, we developed several points, about 86 points of interest. And so we developed more than that, but there are a couple hundred, but some of them we were able to exclude, right? Because some of them we were able to look at and go, no, that's definitely a cow bone. We don't need to go out there, a cow skull. We don't need to go look at that. But because they're with drones, we don't have any scale in a lot of the pictures. And so I can't say with confidence, I can say that it's a bone, but I can't say if it's a critter bone or a human bone. And so the goal is, we have another search actually planned for coming up pretty quick, I think this weekend. And in that search, what the intent is to go out and identify all those points and try to put hands on these anomalies and figure out what they are. See if we can locate evidence, or see if we can locate remains, or see if we can locate anything that we can exclude as evidence. And so that's exciting that we've been able to get all these different organizations to work together. I think that if this is productive, I could see future missing person cases. If we had a way of, we being law enforcement and search and rescue, if we had a way of optimizing a search pattern based on not only human behavior, but the terrain. And Texas Search and Rescue, they're experts in search and rescue, and law enforcement, that's not my bag. And so I defer to the experts. But it would be amazing if we had the ability in a future date to lay in factors that we know and give us an area of optimized search so that we could direct resources there in a timely fashion. I think we'd have a higher positive outcome in cases if we were able to do that.
Kent continues to tell Jason's story in hopes that it may help another family avoid the tragedy that his family has been living through for almost a year.
We put a Facebook page together, Find Jason Landry. We've been putting pictures and videos just to kind of let people get a chance to kind of know them. They're not just numbers, they're people. It's a privilege to share. You know, and frankly, I think keeping it simple, I think we don't know yet because God is using Jason's story to touch people. I can't tell you the number of parents of college students that have contacted me, and I would tell those parents the simplest thing, if you could do one thing, would be to work out a deal with your child, because every phone, of course, has, you know, a password to get into it. Know what that number is. Work out a deal. And I told parents, I'm like, you know, if we had had that four-digit code, we literally, within a few hours, could have had exactly where he was, what was going on, because we lost data from his phone in trying to unlock it and all of that. And what I just told parents is make a deal. Have them write down their code and give it to someone they trust, a friend, you know, grandma, aunt, you know, big sister, whatever. And only if there's that emergency that, you know, you could call and say, like I would tell Cobb, give it to his big sister. I don't want it. I don't want him to hide it. Just give it to his big sister. And if it were an emergency and I had his phone, I could call his big sister and say, what's the number? And you could get that information and maybe find those people. because, you know, frankly, we live on our phones. If you want to find out what someone's up to, open their phone. And so if they had that one piece of information, that would be the one thing I would share, is for them to, doesn't matter how old your kids are, just work out something, respect their privacy, but do so in a way that in this particular case, that you would be able to get that information, because it might be the thing that helps break the case open to find them before it's too late. Because as you know, once you pass that 48 or 72 hour window, the odds really drop down, because if something happens, it's too late. So I would just encourage people to have those difficult conversations, because it's a whole lot better to do that than to be left wondering where your child is.
Jason's brother Kyle struggles with the mysterious nature of his brother's sudden disappearance and the not knowing.
I've always been pretty good at either distracting myself or being able to avert my mind from that kind of thing. But I mean, some days it gets harder than others, obviously. I mean, I don't know what could have happened. Could have been picked up off the side of the road and taken, for all we know, for whatever purpose. And it's definitely hard to know, and something you kind of wrestle with every day. Never really goes away. Pretty much after I left from Luling, right after that, I just kind of went back up to College Station and just took a couple days to myself with my roommates there. Tried to distract myself in a way. And I always had a tough time listening to my family talk about it, because I am not one that likes to revisit details that I already know, because I know I'm going to remember them the rest of my life. Very hard to, while we were there, to picture what had happened, because it was just so foreign to me and my father, especially because we were the only ones that really stayed there the entire time. We just kind of worked it out in our heads of what really happened. I mean, he got in a car crash, and then there's just a trail of stuff going down the road, and then a whole lot of nothing. And then every day you're just waiting for an answer that never comes.
For Jason's mom, Lisa, the not knowing is difficult. She worries about getting that phone call with terrible news, but also that that phone call may never come, and they may never know what happened to Jason.
It's how we can survive day by day, because it's just so hard living in the limbo, not knowing. I just keep wondering, are we gonna, you know, there's always that we could get a phone call at any time and they know something, and then there's the, well, will we ever know? Try not to think about what might have happened to him, like what horrible thing he went through. Try not to go there, because I don't know what happened, so I don't want to create situations in my head that didn't happen. Everybody handles it so differently, and even the four of us are all doing it differently. Not letting my imagination run wild like we were just talking about. My husband tends to do that. We're very different, and then I see things as, in the best case, look for the good things in a situation, and he tends to see the worst first, and so I have to try to help him stay away from all those worst situations, because we don't even know what happened. I don't know. I just miss my baby, want him home, but I'll see him one day, and that helps me get through it too. I know we'll be together for, you know, for eternity. So, and I was thinking, you know, he's probably up there going, oh, my parents will be fine. We'll see him soon. But we've got to live it now for however many years that is. I picture him up there in heaven with his big giant smile and hugging everyone and just happy. And that's how I get through this, is I picture him happy.
So what happened to Jason Landry late in the evening of December 13th, 2020, after he arrived in Luling, Texas and missed his turn? Did he simply drive onto a dark, desolate road, got into an accident and walked away, never to be found? Was Jason in a disoriented state, possibly experiencing hypothermia? Or did something more sinister occur that night? Could Jason have run into some trouble after arriving in Luling? Today, searches continue for Jason in the surrounding areas, and his family remains hopeful that they will soon find answers, and are grateful for all of those who have stepped up to help find Jason. If you have any information regarding the disappearance of Jason Landry, here's Captain Ferry one more time with the best ways that you can reach out to him.
My name is Officer Jeff Ferry. You can call the Sheriff's Office at 512 398-6777. My extension is 4504. I can also be reached by email at Jeff, J-E-F-F, dot ferry, that's like the boat, F-E-R-R-Y, at C-O dot Caldwell, C-A-L-D-W-E-L-L, dot T-X, dot U-S. The family is offering a reward, and you may absolutely remain anonymous for any information you provide to us.
People ask me, you know, I'm a pastor, and they think, has this hurt your faith? And it actually hasn't. The thing that has made the difference to us, the only thing that makes this me get through the day, is knowing without any doubt that if Jason has passed away, he's in heaven, he's in a better place than me, and we're still going to spend all eternity together. That hasn't changed. The only thing that's changed is he got there before me. If we did not know that, I can't imagine how you get through that, because you just would play it all out in your mind. You couldn't put one foot in front of the other, and as hard as it is, you know, that's the only thing that makes us be able to get through this, is we know that as a family, for eternity, nothing has changed. Nothing whatsoever. We'll still spend all eternity together in heaven.
That brings us to the end of episode 312. I'd like to thank everyone who spoke with us for this story. If you have a missing loved one that you'd like to have featured on the show, there's a case submission form at thevanishedpodcast.com. If you'd like to join in on the discussion, there's a page and discussion group on Facebook. I'm on Twitter at thevanishedpod and also on Instagram. If you enjoy this show, subscribe now and leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening right now. Do you want to help support the show? There are a couple things that you can do. One way to help The Vanished is by supporting our sponsors. You can find links and promo codes in the episode notes. Another way to support the show is by contributing on Patreon, where you can get early and ad-free episodes. Be sure to tune in next week. We'll be covering a case from Nebraska. Thanks for listening.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.
In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a 6-part podcast from CBC. Available now.